Love gone very, very wrong. But can you relate?
I think most of us can relate to having been in a relationship that we know is bad for us, but that for whatever reason we can't bring ourselves to extract ourselves from it. And being able to relate to that kind of destructive relationship, I think it's something that makes it possible for a reader to read the story about a relationship that almost certainly they would not have, and to say, okay, I can kind of see where these people are coming from.
That's novelist Rebecca Coleman. We talk with her about her psychological thriller, Kingdom of Childhood. It's about an affair between a female teacher and a teenage student. But first, guest host Michael Pollitt talks with folk musician and critic Scott Alaric about his first work of fiction, Revival.
I think of Revival as it's a love story within a love story. There is the love story of Nathan Warren, but then there's this larger love story about the folk world and how it exists today as a community music.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sometimes a book comes across my transom, and I realize in all humility that I might not be the best person to interview the author. When I received Scott Alaric's novel Revival in the mail and saw that it was deeply steeped in the world of folk music, I thought immediately of a former co-host on Writer's Voice, Michael Pollitt. Michael is a folk music enthusiast, and I thought he would be the perfect host to interview Alaric, as he has both a fine appreciation for literature and broad knowledge of the folk music scene. Scott Alaric has covered that scene for 25 years for the Boston Globe and Public Radio. He's also written for many national magazines, including Sing Out, Billboard, and Performing Songwriter. Alaric is a performing songwriter in the folk tradition and former editor of the New England Folk Almanac. His first book, published in 2003, was the nonfiction Deep Community, Adventures in the Modern Folk Underground. But for his second book, Revival, Alaric decided to turn to fiction to tell a love story, one that involves a romance between a couple and their love affair with the music. Here's guest host Michael Pollack talking with Scott Alaric.
Scott Alaric, welcome to Writer's Voice. It's good to have a folk song lover on the show.
Well, it's great to be on a book show with a folk music book.
Good, good, good. Well, you've written a wonderful novel that describes and inhabits almost every aspect of the New England folk music scene. Would you say it's from the 1980s to the present? Is that the time of your book?
Well, it's contemporary in that kind of vague way that a novel can be contemporary. I mean, I would like to think that if somebody read it in 10 years, they could think it was contemporary. But the main character, Nathan Warren, is a middle-aged guy, songwriter, who had a very real brush with national fame. He made a major label record that was all set to be released, and then there was a staff shakeup at the label, had nothing to do with him or his music, and the album was never released, which pretty much destroyed him professionally and personally. He's just climbing out of this epic depression and drinking problem when the book begins. But time frame, I would just say it's contemporary.
Yeah. Well, the reader gets to live through everything that's part of a folk music scene, from open mics and local concert organizing, dealing with music critics and radio programs, small independent and large national recording companies, working with artists, managers, recording studios, and then, of course, living alongside what the musicians go through as they become songwriters, performers, and going on tours and sharing stories and lessons and working in recording studios. It's really a feast there that you've laid out and a feat, may I say.
Thank you.
So how did, Scott, how did this book come about? Why did you write the story?
Well, I've spent my working life in folk music, first as a traveling performer based in Minnesota, and then when I moved to Boston, I very quickly became the folk critic for the Boston Globe, which I did for a little more than 20 years, and I released a book in 2003 called Deep Community, Adventures in the Modern Folk Underground, which is a series of articles and interviews and profiles and feature stories that I wrote mostly for the Globe, but also for Sing Out, and a little paper I ran in the 90s called the New England Folk Almanac. And when I laid that out in a book, I realized something that I had felt in my years as a music journalist writing about folk music, that there were aspects to being in the folk music world of the 21st century that I wasn't really able to write in short-form nonfiction. You know, that especially the things you were describing, Michael, you know, what it's like to live as a modern folk musician, what it's like to write a song, what it's like to deal with a music industry that refuses to recognize your existence, what it is to try to keep traditions alive in a corporate culture that doesn't know how to put a barcode on tradition, you know, and also what it's like to love this kind of music and to live in a world that's run on the energy of people who love the music. I dedicated the book to volunteers because the fact that folk music is so much a volunteer-run music form today is profoundly important, not only in keeping the business model viable, but there's a particular kind of energy that somebody brings to it when they're doing something just for the love of it. I know people who listen to public radio understand exactly what I'm talking about. So I wanted to show those things. I wanted to get into the emotions of it and what it feels like to be surrounded by folk music in the 21st century.
And you do. It's really, the book seems to me to be a love story in many ways.
Yes.
Between two people in particular, your two mm-hmm. protagonists.
Yeah.
But exactly as you're saying, the love of music and songs and songwriting, of tradition, and the love of helping musicians find their own voices and styles and places in the folk world. It's a love story. And the other thing that it's struck me is that a lot of novels will use local places, names of people as backdrops for their mm-hmm. stories. You don't use them, all of these places, real places in Cambridge, Massachusetts, house concerts in Gloucester, Passim's Iron Horse in Northampton. You bring these places to the forefront. It's not a backdrop anymore, it seems.
Yes.
And what was your intention in mixing this reality or bringing this reality so far forward in your story?
Well, it's a great observation. I think of revival as it's a love story within a love story. There is the love story of Nathan Warren. The other principal character is a young, ambitious, very talented songwriter named Kit Palmer, in her mid-20s, having what she calls her precocious midlife crisis because she feels like she needs to be focusing on one thing, and she decides she wants to be a songwriter. She's very talented. She's very she's a great songwriter, great musician. She grew up playing fiddle and now plays guitar and writes songs. But she's in every other way unequipped for what it takes to have a career in folk music today, and that's what brings the two of them together. But then, just as you said, Michael, there's this larger love story about the folk world and how it exists today as a community music, as a substream non-commercial music, how it got to be the way it is today. And the scenes like you described, and you know, and I should also add that Nathan Warren, the main character, hosts an open mic and a jam session at a little North Cambridge bar called Dooley's.
Yes.
And I wanted to show how the music exists on the grassroots level, because I think that's what keeps folk music going more than anything else. These little community coffee houses and community open mics. That's where the heart beats. So I think of it as, maybe the best way to describe it would be a love story within a social novel about the folk music world in America in the 21st century.
Now, the tagline on the cover of your book reads, "We come of age more than once."
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean for you in respect to your book?
A major theme in the book is the coming together of the generations. Because you know, Nathan is an older guy and Kit is in her mid-20s, and the reason that I wanted to do that was to show how each generation can lead the other. It's not just a matter of the older people teaching the younger people. It's the younger people teaching the older people, too. And the younger people showing the older people what's important, because they're the ones that are going to carry the traditions on. So what they value, what they cherish, is what's going to last from any tradition. And every generation changes music, makes it their own. They have to. And Nathan, as an open mic host and jam host, he slowly starts to recognize that as he's doing it over the years. And he reflects that once he learned to recognize the sound of a new generation taking possession of the old music, like clumsy, eager lovers, he heard it as the most beautiful music that humans can make. But there's so much about what young Kit Palmer brings to Nathan that, you know, I think she transforms him in more important ways than he helps her. And that's the idea that if we're paying attention, if we're tuned into our life and the lives around us, we will come of age more than once. And there is a coming of age we have at midlife when we become elders, in whatever sense that is in our lives, and we realize that it's our turn to pass the lore along and to pass the stories along and to pass the tradition and the culture along.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. Guest host Michael Pollitt is talking with folk music critic, songwriter, and now novelist Scott Alaric about his novel Revival. It's a love story set in the world of the contemporary New England folk music scene.
Speaking of tradition, that is a theme that runs through your book almost like a chorus of a song.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you.
In fact, I was struck by how much the book is like a song in itself. And maybe we can talk about that. But the chorus...
I thought of it as a ballad. I really did.
Yes. Well, talk a little bit more about folk music and traditions and traditional music. And then I think I would love to ask you to read a little bit from your book.
Well, as I've spent my life in folk music, when I started out, I tended to think of traditional folk songs as old. But I don't anymore. I think of them as living. And they're as modern as the last time anybody played them. They may have had a starting date at some particular point in history, but that's not really terribly important to what it is that keeps people singing them. We may not know what it's like to be a 19th century sailor, but we know what it's like to be homesick and to be away from home and working too hard. We may not know what it's like to be a woman in 16th century culture, but we're still grappling with issues of women's equality and women claiming ownership of their own lives. And so many of the ancient ballads deal with those issues. And the reason I called the book Revival was there are these personal revivals that the characters, all of the major characters in the book, go through the book, but they're very much guided by their growing awareness of what tradition is and what a living force it is, and how it can guide them through the stations of their life. So I wanted one of the major things that readers could think about during the reading of the book is, what does tradition mean in the 21st century? What is it that we're passing along, and how are we doing it? Because I don't think there's a really good mechanized way to do that. It still kind of has to happen human being to human being, which I think is a big reason that folk music remains so vibrant today wherever it exists, because it certainly isn't getting any support from the commercial media, but the yearning for community art, for people's art, and for songs about people's lives as they really live them, I think remains very strong.
Yes, and it's a sudden understanding, I think, that Nathan Warren, one of the two protagonists, suddenly realizes that tradition is community, that's mm-hmm. what it is. It's really another word for community.
Yes. Yeah, I think that is maybe the signal epiphany he has in the book. And I can tell you that felt to me when I was writing it almost like that was something that came from him. It wasn't in any of my notes. It just came when I was writing it. And it felt like, you know, that when you're writing a novel about people that you want other people to think are real, there was a remarkable moment where they began to become their own characters. And the questions I was asking changed from, you know, what should Nathan Warren do here, or what should Nathan Warren say here, changed to what would Nathan say here, what would he do here. And I began, it's a very strange process of learning how to listen, and I listened to Nathan, and that's one of the things that he told me he was figuring out.
And just to add to that, you've been listening for so many years as the folk music critic to the Boston Globe and before with Prairie Home Companion. You've been listening a lot and figuring out a lot of this, and it's wonderful that you've now put this into a book for us. And if you you're welcome. If you just tuned in, I'm talking with Scott Alaric, who has just had his first novel published, or just last year, a few months ago, by Songsmith. And Scott has also written it's a kind of resource book, as far as I can tell. It came before this novel, but it's a resource for the contemporary folk world. It's called Deep Community, Adventures in the Modern Folk Underground, a great book that to keep alongside Revival, his new novel. So, Scott, how about reading a little bit and setting up a reading off of your page 219 there?
Yes, this is a story that I think really illustrates a lot of the things we've been talking about tradition as a living thing and how folk music lives in our culture today. Fame is a funny duck in the folk world. Folks' notion of fame has always been both larger and smaller than the kind of fame pop culture celebrates. Nathan wanted to explore that because it showed some essential demarcation points between folk and the mainstream music industry. He knew a couple of stories that fit the bill. There was one about Joe Cormier, a delightful Cape Breton fiddler who lived in Waltham, Massachusetts, working as an electrician and playing his fiddle for dances on weekends. When he was nearly 60, he was awarded the prestigious National Heritage Fellowship Award, putting him in the league of past winners such as B.B. King, Bill Monroe, Doc Watson, and Mavis Staples. Cormier was suddenly an international star, performing at Carnegie Hall, the Kennedy Center, and the Smithsonian. Someone asked him how it felt to become famous at 60. "Famous?" Cormier said, his eyes twinkling. "Let me tell you a little about being famous." He said he'd grown up in a tiny fishing village in Cape Breton. Even as a boy, he'd shown promise as a fiddler. Every Saturday night, the village held a dance in the town hall. At a certain point, the dancers would stop, the band would put down their instruments, and Joe's father would lift him up on a table. Everybody would gather round while Joe played a few tunes. "Now, let me tell you what I mean by everybody," Cormier said. He said it meant all his neighbors, the parents of the children he went to school with, his teachers and the shopkeepers in town. Every week, the entire town stood around this little boy, looking up at him and cheering as he played the fiddle. And during the week, everywhere he went, he was told how well he had played. By everyone he knew, by everyone his parents knew. Smiling coyly, Cormier said, "Hey, I've been famous all my life." Fame is personal in the folk world. The latest pop superstar might sing before tens of thousands, but they're strangers. How much more intense was the fame Joe Cormier knew in that tiny fishing village? His audiences were the people he saw every day, the men his father worked with, the women his mother talked with over the backyard fence. Even now, fame was like that in the folk world. In the coffee houses, people sat a few feet away from the stage. They wanted to experience art that was close, human, authentic in the most intimate ways. It was personal.
Thank you. Nice to hear you read.
Oh, thank you. I love that story. It probably might not surprise you to know that I was the guy who asked him that question.
Why am I not surprised? So tradition is so very personal, but it's universal. Or what is it? What is that quality of tradition that turns into the universal and keeps the artists alive for us over decades?
I think you really hit on it there, Michael. I think that's the peculiar power of tradition, is that it is simultaneously personal and universal. Like I was saying, you know, we may not know how people lived 300 years ago, but when we listen to them sing a love song, we know exactly how they felt. Mm. And it's what Nathan realizes when he realizes that tradition is another word for community, and that it's a powerful thing when we realize that community can exist not only with people around us, but with the people who came before us. This is their way of passing along to us what's really important in life, because only what's really important lasts in a song, or in a piece of music. It doesn't get passed along. It doesn't. I mean, the amount of traditional music that we have today is just a sliver compared to what's existed over the centuries, of course. And what gets passed down to us is what's true, and what's lasting about it, and it helps us understand what's important about the human condition. The same kind of yearnings and longings, the fear of death, and the feeling of powerlessness when we're working for somebody else, and what people dream and what they want their lives to be. And when you hear that echoed in an old cowboy song or in a soldier's wife's lament from the 16th century, we realize some very basic things about the human condition and what's universal about it, but we realize it in such intimate and emotional ways.
And you say it survives by changing. Now that's quite a rich statement. Usually things survive by staying as still as possible, you know. Mm-hmm. But it changes. Now, if you want to talk about that, but also tell us about what kind of community do you hear in today's singers and songs? What's changing in the tradition? What are you hearing?
Well, I've always seen the songwriter as part of the tradition. It gets a little harder to discern with a modern song where tradition enters in and where the commercial instincts enter in. But that's been true ever since there's been a music industry. You know, it's kind of hard to define the lines between pop music and folk music sometimes. But to me, as I was saying before, tradition is a living thing. And Nathan in the novel very much believes that. And Kit Palmer comes to believe that too. That it's a living thing. And if it's a living thing, then it's always growing and changing. It can't stay the same. And one of the things I realized from covering folk music for so many years for the Boston Globe is that it's a myth that there was ever a moment when a traditional music was pure and fixed and correct. Tradition has always been changing. I was told by some Irish musicians and then shown some of the comments that were written in the, I believe, in the late 16th century, early 17th century, when Irish musicians screamed and hollered that Irish music would be destroyed forever if that Italian monstrosity, the violin, was allowed into Irish music. And, of course, Irish music and the other folk musics of Europe changed the violin so much that it became a fiddle. But it did change the music. The music, we have very little idea what Irish music sounded like before the violin came in. And it's the same kind of screaming that happened in British folk music in the 60s about the guitar coming in, because the guitar was an American instrument and it was going to destroy British music. It didn't. It helped it a lot, but it changed it. And, you know, when the Clancy brothers first started singing Irish music in this sort of American folk group style with a guitar, and on one of their early albums they had Pete Seeger playing the banjo. A lot of Irish music people said, oh, this is going to be the end of Irish music. It saved it, again, because music has to be contemporary, I think, it can be an old song, but it has to be changing and taking in. And one of the things Nathan realizes is that this is really the way tradition exists, that it revivals of the music aren't things that happen once every couple of generations, that this is a constant process. It's the way a tradition stays alive. It's the way it breathes, constantly inhaling what's new and modern around it, and then exhaling what's wasteful or ephemeral, and keeping what's lasting and what's true about the music. It's why old folk songs have, you know, hundreds of different variations, different variants, because everybody's adapting them to their own lives, just like a plant adapts to whatever environment it's put into.
But now, what happens with contemporary songwriting? The songs are copyrighted. Mm-hmm. They can't be changed.
Right.
Or can they? What happens now with this passing along of songs?
That's actually something that's discussed in the book. That when Nathan is invited to talk about music at a course at Harvard, and he starts talking about the copyright law changed the nature of music a lot in that songs that are written now, they can't change, they aren't free to change the way they were in when we didn't know who wrote them. But the advantage, of course, is that we get to know who wrote them. And it's cool to know something about Bob Dylan and where he was in his life when he wrote Blowin' in the Wind. Wouldn't you love to know, you know, who wrote Water is Wide and who it was about? But, and we can never know that, or who wrote Greensleeves. There are all kinds of theories, but nobody knows. But still, the music still changes. And if you listen to the way traditional music particularly is played today, it's quite different than the way it was played 20 years ago or 200 years ago. And the way people write songs changes from generation to generation. But I think the folk music's mission remains the same, which is to be the music for real people. It's going to be a music that is about ordinary people, their lives, their struggles, their dreams, their loves, the way they actually live their lives, and the world that they see outside their window every morning.
That's Scott Alaric talking about the folk music world and his novel set in it, Revival. He'll talk more with guest host Michael Pollitt after the break. Don't go away.
In constant sorrow.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're listening to an interview guest host Michael Pollitt did in January with Scott Alaric about his novel of the contemporary folk music scene.
Well, your novel, Revival, seems to me that it mirrors a folk song. It's almost like a song in itself. And you said earlier in the interview that you had in mind it being something of a ballad. It certainly is the movement of a love story with a profound and poignant twist at the end, but it's much larger than that. Can you tell me a little bit about, were you aware of this, as that you were perhaps writing a song of a book?
I can tell you that writing Revival is the most musical thing I've ever done. And that includes, you know, making CDs and writing songs and doing concerts and writing about folk music for the Boston Globe for so many years. And it was musical on every level. It was musical in the way, in the emotions that the story contained. But there's a music to the language, too. I became aware of a music to the prose, and I tried to follow it. It's I tried to tell the story as simply as I could, but I felt a music to it. And at the same time, Nathan is the kind of person who spends a lot of time wondering about music and, you know, thinking about why is it that we love sad songs? Why do we love to listen to sad songs all the time? And he wonders about tradition. What is it that keeps a song alive? And how is it that we can feel, what is it in a song that allows us to feel the emotions, the living emotions of someone who's been dead for 800 years? What is it that there's so much mystery to how that is able to happen? And I wanted to, one of the things that made me want to write a novel is that unlike in journalism, you don't have to answer questions. And some of the best questions, the most important questions, don't have answers. It's just what you figure out by asking them. And I wanted to really explore the mystery of folk music and the mystery of music. What is it about music that we're the only creatures that have it? What is it that made us create music? What do we need from music? What is the need that it fulfills? And there's a middle-aged folk music critic named Ferguson in the book who describes music as another language, that it's a human language that we invented to say things to each other that we couldn't say in words. And I think that gets close to it, but I really wanted to explore all of that. This is very much a book not just set in the music world, but very much a book about music and why we love music.
Well, and that book is Revival, a Folk Music Novel. It's by Scott Alaric, the person you've just been listening to and are listening to. And Scott, before we leave you here, who should we be listening to now? Speaking of music and songs, who would you recommend? What venues should we be supporting and going to hear today's folk voices? Radio stations, perhaps?
Excuse me?
Radio stations as well?
Public radio is where you find folk music. There is a great internet folk music station called Folk Alley, where you can go find people. One of the things that's wonderful about the internet that makes it such a saving grace for folk music, I think, is that it's so easy to find the music. It's never been so easy to find all kinds of folk music. I mean, Amazon has a Leadbelly store. I would never have left my room at 15 if I had found a Leadbelly store online. And the music's never been easier to find, but I would just, rather than recommending any specific people, just urge people to dive in, start Googling and going to websites. Of course, in Western Mass, there's the Great Iron Horse and a number of radio stations that have folk music. And you can just look at names of artists and click on them, go to their website, and you can hear their music. And, you know, you're not going to like all of it, but just find the stuff that moves you. And it's I'm very, very hopeful for folk music's future. I think there's more of it being played in more different ways by more different people than there were in the 60s or at any other time, certainly any time since the coming of the music industry. And it's never been easier for people to run the music on the fuel, completely on the fuel of their own love for the music.
It's been wonderful talking with you, Scott.
Great talking to you, Michael.
Appreciate you taking the time to give us this here at Writer's Voice. And we've been listening to Scott Alaric talk about his folk music novel, Revival, which just came out actually a few months ago, out on Songsmith.
Mm-hmm.
An independent, talking about independent songwriters, an independent publisher out of Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Yes, it's an imprint of Peter E. Randall Publisher, and we're hoping to get more books for people who love this kind of music and to think about music in these ways, get more books like that out into the world.
Wonderful. And don't miss Scott Alaric's Deep Community, Adventures in the Modern Folk Underground. It's a collection of all your journalism, your essays and interviews, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
With folk people, well, the musicians themselves, but all the people that are part of the infrastructure of the folk world.
Yeah, I put it together in a way that it's somewhat like revival to try to create a landscape, if you will, of the modern folk world and how it exists and who inhabits it and what the music's like.
Well, the two of them together are wonderful. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael, very much.
You're welcome.
That was Scott Alaric talking with Michael Pollitt. Michael was a co-host on Writer's Voice several years ago and then went on to found his own radio show about oral history. It's called Spinning Tales. It broadcasts live from WMCB LP-FM in downtown Greenfield, Massachusetts. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to Michael's show and also to hear Scott Alaric perform one of his songs. Next up, Rebecca Coleman and a tale of love gone very, very wrong. We've all seen the news stories about the teacher who has an affair with an adolescent student. The most sensational is when the affair is between a female teacher and a male student. It violates several boundaries at once. Women are supposed to be nurturing and protective, not sexual predators. And it often seems like society can't make up its mind whether the boy is a victim or he got lucky. Rebecca Coleman heightens the tension in her novel about one such affair by setting it within the privileged and protective community of a Waldorf school. The novel's title, Kingdom of Heaven, is taken from the title of a book by Rudolf Steiner, the German humanist who founded the Waldorf system of education in 1919. In Kingdom of Heaven, a troubled Waldorf kindergarten teacher seduces a 16-year-old boy who attends a school. The consequences spell tragedy for all concerned. Rebecca Coleman was a semi-finalist for the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award for The Kingdom of Heaven. I started out our interview by asking Coleman how she got the idea for the book.
I was watching a news broadcast that was discussing one of those affairs between an older female teacher and a young male student, and I think I had the same reaction that most people do when they see that, where you think, how could she do that? You know, as I think as a parent, your natural response is repugnance and total lack of understanding. And because I'm also a writer, you know, my mind is always looking for interesting things to write a story about. And to me, the most interesting thing in a character is when it's somebody whose motives are inexplicable. You cannot naturally understand why on earth they would do this thing. And if you can figure out why they would, then you have a really interesting character there.
Yeah, it's a real exploration, I think, into the darker side of what, you know, maybe a darker side that we all share. It's just that many of us don't act on our darker impulses, whereas these characters, and I'm thinking now really in particular of the protagonist, Judy McFarlane, the teacher, she does.
Right.
So tell us about these two main characters, Judy and Zach.
Judy is a 43-year-old Waldorf kindergarten teacher, and initially she seems to be someone that maybe you can relate to. And she's a typical mom, frustrated in her marriage, and she seems kind of funny. But as the story goes on, she breaks down, and you start seeing what's underneath the facade that she has put up all this time, and you start wondering if she's been like that all along or if it's the affair that's causing her to break down that way. Zach is a 16-year-old boy, and I think he's a pretty typical one. He's from kind of what you think of as a crunchy granola kind of family. Zoe Heller, when she wrote Notes on a Scandal, which is the only other book I know of that's on a similar topic, the boy that she chose for that role is kind of from a rough-and-tumble family, very blue-collar. And I think that that's kind of the go-to character in that role, is some kid from a family that is rough around the edges and not paying much attention. And I thought it would be more interesting to have a kid there whose family is very invested in him and who's taken very good care of him, and see what would happen to him in that role.
So talk a little bit about the motivations. I mean, we don't want to give too much away, but, you know, this is really a psychological exploration of character. So without giving away too much of the plot, can you give us what you feel are some of the deeper motivations that are going on in these characters?
Well, I think most of us can relate to having been in a relationship that we know is bad for us, but that for whatever reason we can't bring ourselves to extract ourselves from it. We just can't walk away. And being able to relate to that kind of destructive relationship, I think is something that makes it possible for a reader to read the story about a relationship that almost certainly they would not have, and to say, okay, I can kind of see where these people are coming from. And also, like the characters in the book, I think that a lot of us come into our adult lives very informed by our experiences as children and by what we saw in our families growing up, and trying to reconcile our parents' actions or our parents' mistakes with who we are going to be as adults. That can be a real struggle in adulthood, to not make the same mistakes that your parents made. And that's something that Judy is going through in the book and is mostly failing at, and that Zach is starting to come into, where he's seen that his mother has had an affair. He's not sure if his father knows about it. He loves his mother, and he's trying to reconcile his love for his mother and his image of her as being this wonderful person with what he knows she's done. And so, in a way, he's acting out, and he's trying to figure out, is this just what adults do? Do all adults behave this way?
Now, you're writing this book within a very particular setting. I mean, in fact, a setting of a school, a type of school, the Waldorf School. The Waldorf schools in general really seek to protect their children to the
yes.
utmost degree. I mean, I know this by personal experience because my son went to a Waldorf school. And why did you decide to set this disturbing story within, you know, and not only that, she's a kindergarten teacher. I mean, that's even the most protective.
Yeah, mm-hmm. In Waldorf terms, the kindergarten teachers, you know, where it all begins, and they're the really the keeper of the Waldorf idea of a child, the childhood ideal. And I've been interested in Waldorf schools all my life, since I was 14 when I first walked into one as a guest, and all this time I've always found them fascinating. And so I wanted to set this story in that type of school because, for one thing, it's a place where I like to live in my mind for a couple of years while I could write the story, because it's such a beautiful environment. But also because of that ideal that you're talking about, that they do seek to protect children and they place such a high premium on it, and even on constructing the child's consciousness in a way that protects it from negative influences, that in a typical public high school, for a story like What Goes On in the Kingdom of Childhood to happen there, that would be unfortunate but not an enormous surprise. But for that to happen in a Waldorf school, it not only goes against our cultural expectations for teachers and students, but it goes, in the Waldorf school, it goes against everything. It goes against it spiritually. It goes against the very nature of the relationship between the students and teachers there. And that made for higher stakes, even though it was also, in a way, asking for trouble from the Waldorf community.
Higher stakes, is that just what it was, or was there also something more? I mean, I've often wondered, is there something particular about having these high, sometimes very rigid ideals that then almost invites breaking them?
Yeah, I know what you're saying, and I didn't really want to get into that in the story because my main focus was on how devastating this would be for both Zach and Judy because of their involvement in the Waldorf community, that this was completely anathema to the environment that they were in. At the time I was writing it, I didn't have really strong criticisms of the Waldorf community to make. But since then, I have seen comments from quite a few people who have experience in that community, who have said that that because of the nature of some things about the schools, that these kinds of relationships between older men and younger girls have happened in the schools that they've been involved with, and that they've been either excused or written off and things like that. And I find that disturbing and kind of fascinating, and I certainly don't assume it happens in Waldorf schools any more than in the average school. But I do think it could have something to do with what you're saying, that the rigidity of the belief system means that it can be taken advantage of or corrupted by people who are of a mind to do so.
Hmm. It may be something about just conformity, that people don't want to rock the boat, that things may not be so open.
And a resistance to seeing that there could be a problem here. Mm-hmm. Because if you're very highly invested in the idea that this is an ideal community, you're going to be less willing to see when a problem is really creeping in.
Yeah. We're talking with Rebecca Coleman about her novel, The Kingdom of Childhood, and it is a psychological thriller, in a way, the story of an affair between a 16-year-old boy and a woman, a teacher at a Waldorf school. I read on your website a little bit about kind of the background to this book, and I was fascinated to read that the reaction of some men to what's going on, to what's happened to Zach, is that he got lucky.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that and what your reaction to that is?
It is very interesting that one of the things that was motivating me as I wrote this was the, even though I try not to be preachy in the book, I try not to kind of put forth an agenda, one person who read it said that the book is so non-judgmental in a way that it's almost like a photograph, and I thought that was a very nice way to describe it. But personally, you know, inside myself, of course I had an agenda. I wanted to say that this is really wrong, and I had been really startled by things like, I think it was the Houston Chronicle last spring posted a list of the 10 or 12 hottest female sex offenders, most of whom are guilty of the same crime that appears in the book. We would never do that if the shoe was on the other foot, you know, if it was a male, you know, pursuing young girls. But for some reason, people tend not to see this between a female teacher and a younger male student as a crime. And I wanted to say this is a crime for all of these reasons. It's a terrible betrayal of these young men to see it in any other way. So I was approaching it that way. And I was surprised when, in discussing this with some male friends, it just turned it into a joke. And they'd say, oh, well, don't be too hard on that teacher, because that kid is just lucky. You've got to be kidding me. And I think it has a lot to do with our culture and the way that we seem to see that men are expected to always be open to sex and always ready, and that they can't be victimized. And that's just not fair, especially when you're talking about teenagers. And we're so willing to say, oh, teenage girls are mature emotionally so much faster than teenage boys. But when you're talking about a relationship like this, you know, you say, oh, well, of course he's ready for it.
And you bring a personal perspective to this. I mean, I think I can probably say this because you write about it on your website, mm-hmm. that when you were a teenager, you got into a relationship with someone who was also much older than you. How do you use your own experience through the eyes of Zach in this book?
I projected onto Zach a lot of the things that I felt at that time, that I didn't know how to remove myself from the situation once I realized that it wasn't good for me, that I felt like I was in over my head, and that I didn't know how to manage this person who had so much more experience than me and who could talk down to me. And I felt like I deserved it because I was so naive, and it was my own fault somehow for being too naive to understand. And I passed all of those things along to Zach in the book, and I think that's realistic, even though we're different genders. And in a way, it was quite cathartic to put it through Zach that way, and to feel sympathy for him myself and to feel like his feelings were credible. It was like I hadn't, when I was younger, given myself permission to feel that way about myself. But when I projected it onto a character, I could say, oh, you poor kid, somebody should be helping you.
So you could develop a kind of compassion for yourself that you hadn't really felt toward yourself when you were going through the experience.
Yeah, and I would hope that that teenagers who read my book, and it does seem to be really rather popular among 16 to 18-year-olds, which kind of surprises me, but maybe because School Library Journal recommended it for that age group. But I hope that they would read it and be able to kind of play the whole tape, as they say in, like, 12-stepping programs. Say, before you get into a relationship with a person who's much older than you, think about where this is going to end up. Think about all the things that you won't be able to handle. And if it is a statutory rape situation, that you're in the position now of hiding a crime, because this older person is going to be held legally responsible. And so, well, on the one hand, you could think, oh, this is, you know, I'm so enticing, and this is a situation that's working up for both of us. You are hiding a crime, and that's something that is a great burden on someone who's that young.
And also, teenagers have such a great sense of invulnerability, of great power, that it can be even more difficult for them to maybe admit their vulnerability in a situation like this.
Yeah, I agree with that. Probably especially young men who are in a position of trying to prove their masculinity to themselves and to the world, that it could be really hard to admit that you just can't handle this this situation, or that you are a victim.
Mm-hmm. All your characters, they have, you know, they're light and dark. You can see their humanity and their flaws, but nonetheless, it seems to me that this book, Kingdom of Childhood, Rebecca Coleman, is also about the corruption of power and the
Yes.
corruption of obsession. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I feel like when I was writing it, I wanted to get at a kind of fatal attraction sort of ending, with showing in a really stark way what a sexual obsession can do to a person. And so, you know, in the course of writing that, I put in all of these things that are going to raise the stakes for these characters and make it very hard for them to extract themselves. And I feel like that, again, that that's something that a lot of us can relate to, where we've been in a romantic relationship or a sexual relationship where we think, at some point, I don't know how far I would go to keep this from ending. You know, I feel like I am desperate for this relationship not to end, and I see this person pulling away from me. How can I stop it? Now, most of us wouldn't, you know, do anything like in Fatal Attraction, where you're killing the family pets, or like in The Kingdom of Childhood, where Judy is starting to deteriorate into violence and threats of death on people and things like that. But it's something where we can look at it, and I think a lot of us can think, I wouldn't have done that, but I understand what's going on in her head that she is choosing to do that.
And she's driven by a need that goes way back.
Yes, going back to her childhood, from when she had a crush on a teenage boy in Germany where she lived at the time. She was considerably younger, and that's a dynamic that I found really interesting to write about, is that she was 10 and has this enormous crush on this boy who's about 16 or 17, and she's old enough to be boy crazy in the way where she has this crush on him, but much too young to act on it. And he's much too old for her to see her in that way. He just sees her as a cute little friend. And so that internal frustration and her inability to act on these budding feelings of romance and even love that she has for this young man end up carrying all the way through her adult years. So she has this unsatisfied need. And right now I'm reading a picture of Dorian Gray, and it's got this wonderful quote in it about how about the needs that we feel, and that the only way that we can satisfy them is by acting on them. And if we don't act on them, it will always remain in us unsatisfied. And I don't completely agree with that, but I definitely think that that's what Judy feels in the book, that she must find a way at some point in her life to redeem this this love she had for this young man, and she ends up finding it with Zach, but of course by then she's much too old to do that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to ask you, I read that this was an Amazon book pick. Was this something that you submitted to Amazon?
It was a 2010 semi-finalist in the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award competition, so it ranked pretty highly in the contest. That was a great adventure. It's something that I'd recommend to any writer. The Amazon contest, which is just starting again at the beginning of January, is a lot of fun, and it gives writers, it's free to participate in. Amazon does not pay me to say this or anything of the sort. But I had a good time rising up through the ranks of it and getting to network with other writers who ended up going on to have their own publishing careers shortly after the contest.
So how did that work?
It's the rare contest where you can participate on forums so that you get to know the other people who are in it.
So you submit your book and people read it? How does it actually work?
You submit a pitch and you submit your manuscript, and at first they evaluate just the pitches. And the pitches that get through, the manuscripts attached to them are then read by one series of judges, and then they're read by judges from Publishers Weekly. And Publishers Weekly gives them a review. And because my review from Publishers Weekly was so flattering, I was able to incorporated it into my query letter that I used with agents and caught the attention of the agent that I ended up getting, which is something that if you're a writer and have attempted querying in the past is so hard. You know, it's so hard to distinguish yourself from the enormous pile of queries that they get, but having a review from Publishers Weekly saying, hey, this is a pretty good book, is incredibly helpful.
Yeah, bet. And so, and I'm surprised that it was recommended by Library Journal, you said, for children. I mean, it's not a difficult book to read, but
it has a lot of sex in it.
Well, not just that. It has a lot of sex. That's one thing too. But it's tough to consider these things as you're reading it. You know, there are a lot of gulp moments there.
Yeah, I agree, and there are some things in there where there's one scene that, you know, I'm sure you know it, and I can't go into too much detail because it would ruin it for everyone, but a scene that was so intense that I submitted two other versions to my editor, and I said, you know, you can use one of these other ones if you like, because I think readers might read this and go, oh, you know, and set the book down and never pick it back up again. And she said, no, I like it the way it is. Okay. So it ended up going to press like that. But I agree, there are points in the book where even I, as the author, think, wow, that's pretty messed up. And so I was surprised when School Library Journal recommended it for older teens also, but I can understand why they did, because it does incorporate the perspective of a teenage boy, and it is a cautionary tale. So
yeah,
it could be helpful to older teens.
Well, the book is The Kingdom of Childhood. It's a terrific read, and we've been speaking with the author, Rebecca Coleman. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.